In the name of the source of life, infinitely compassionate, infinitely merciful. We're here as part of a spiritual retreat, so I feel it's appropriate to give us every opportunity to deepen with some silence and some presence. So let's take some moments together and bring your finest attention to the breath. And with every out-breath, allow yourself to let go of whatever needs to be let go of at this moment. And with every in-breath, allow yourself to open and to be receptive to whatever this moment is going to bring us. We approach these precious moments in a state of pure receptivity and unknowing. Let's just accept that we're all here together, and we invite the presence of God, the inspiration and guidance of God, to give us what we need. And one of the gifts of the universe to us is the gift of sound. Sufis use sound to work with energy, to unite hearts, to focus ourselves, and create a resonance among ourselves. And one of the beautiful divine names dear to us is the divine name of Hu, which you can think of as the pronoun of divine presence. The pronoun of divine presence, Hu, like the fundamental Hu-ness of the universe. Join our voices together in the sound of Hu, like this. Hu. Settle in for some moments with no particular effort other than letting yourself be, opening up to your own interior presence. Experience that. So this is a taste of the inner, hopefully of inner spaciousness. Of a capacity for receptivity and of the reality of what we are inside. And when the topic of inner and outer was proposed for this conference, the first thing that came to my mind was the importance of the human being developing this inwardness of our own being, and how this is absolutely essential to live our lives, particularly to meet the circumstances of life today. That this is the work that's before us. The work of becoming human. Now, by calling it work, I don't really mean to make it sound like drudgery. Drudgery is worldliness. Drudgery is being enslaved to ambition, desire, obsession. But work is a, you know, it's a beautiful word, like when an artist makes a work of art. and you are your own work. And the work has also been a term applied not only to the practice of Gurdjieffians, which some of you may know, but it's much older than that. It's a Sufi term. It's the work of alchemy, and it's the work of really developing our humanness. Now, one of the things that I had proposed to the organizers of the conference, and they reminded me that I proposed this, and they said, please remember to include this in your talk, was to talk about the sources of the tradition of Sufism, particularly the Quran and the Hadith of the Prophet. Many things we could talk about, but I'm going to try and share with you a perspective, maybe even bring you a little bit into a world of the classical Sufi and what shapes the perception, what has shaped the vision and the experience of Sufis for 14 centuries. And in doing this, I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything or say that this is the way or the only way, but to share my own experience of having sort of gradually grown into this framework and how it's changed my perception, my life, the universe that I experience. So I'm just curious. I'd like to do a little survey here, and I'm just curious, of all of us who are here, how many of us would say that the Quran has been of really significant importance in your spiritual journey? Okay, good. And that's good, and all the rest of you who didn't raise your hands, that's great. That makes it useful for me to share with you some things about the Quran, and I hope perhaps demolish some preconceptions and open up a vista that is the true vista of revelation and is not the myopic vision of institutional religion or certain things that claim to be orthodoxy. I'm not coming from some monolithic sense of what the truth is or Islamic orthodoxy, but I'm coming from a growing relationship with the voice that spoke through the Quran, the intelligence that spoke through it. And I need to talk a little bit about our present moment in history. I need to talk a little bit about how Sufism, over all these centuries, has grown organically from a crystal, you might say, or from a seed. And the seed it has grown from is the revelation of the Quran. And why do I say that? Because certainly we've heard it said by certain people that there have always been Sufis. Sufis have predated Islam, for instance. Some people say this. And if we mean there's always been mystics like ourselves searching for the truth who have been somewhat independent of the, shall we say, consensus reality of their society, and have been somewhat independent of institutional religion. Yes, such people have always existed. But is there something that's really characteristic about this path that we call Sufism? Or is it just a kind of universal, shall we say, context for putting all the whole history of human spiritual experience into that context? Well, it could be both. It could be both that universal context that sets all of the religious experience of mankind into a certain perspective. And it can also be a ripened fruit of something. In other words, it could be something that has its own very distinct characteristics. And if we were to ask ourselves, well, what are the real unique characteristics of Sufism that perhaps drew us to it in the first place? Because after all, there are many great sacred traditions on this planet. And in my own life, starting really when I was in my early teens, I began to search these traditions. I was raised as a Catholic, and I had a good Catholic education with Jesuits, and I learned Latin, and I had the best, you might say, of what that could offer. But then, still at an early age, I was drawn into Buddhism, and I studied Sanskrit, and I practiced Buddhism, and related Advaita Vedanta. At least I explored these things. So that was part of my life. My early seeking was really in the traditions of the Far East. I'm not a stranger to that. And Sufism was the last tradition I encountered, the last tradition I had an opportunity to taste and practice. And it's the one that has satisfied my heart ever since. If I were to describe how it looks to me and with the beauty that I found in Sufism, I would say, above all, it's integration with life. That especially among the teachers and elders that I have, you know, been blessed to know, their beauty was their groundedness, their humanness, their integration with family, society, community, a practical livelihood. All of my teachers had jobs, for one thing. One of them said, if your enlightenment prevents you from holding a job, it's a limited enlightenment. Most of them had families and marriage. And yet, within this context, they reached the highest spiritual attainments. They became embodiments of something, you know. Today there's a term called creation spirituality, which is quite popular now. Matthew Fox originated it. It's been a kind of remedy for some of the otherworldliness of the Euro-Christian tradition, a rebalancing. But creation spirituality, which means the relationship of spirit to embodiedness, has always been at the heart of Sufism. Because it began with the Prophet Muhammad, who, peace and blessings upon him, who lived and experienced everything a human being could live and experience. He was, in his early years, he was an orphan, for starters. He was a trusted businessman, caravan, shall we say, business manager. But he was also an ascetic who would spend every Ramadan, and we're in the month of Ramadan now. Before he had a revelation, he'd spend the month of Ramadan in a cave, alone, fasting, opening to something. And that was all the more remarkable because there was no model for this in his society. He lived in a society that was more material, in a way, more consumer-oriented than our own. He lived in a society that was about as bereft of spirituality, of true spirituality, as any society on earth at that time. So he had no model for a high spirituality. Nevertheless, he got himself to that cave every Ramadan. He meditated there. And when one night a being appeared to him and it spoke, he ran home to his wife. He said, "Hadija, cover me. I'm going crazy. You know, I'm possessed or something." And she said, "Muhammad, a man like you doesn't go crazy." That he was an unwilling prophet at first. And then he found himself first in a, for I think about 10 years, with a very small community of friends, trying to practice what was given to them against all odds and against a lot of pressure and persecution from the outside, which they suffered passively, nonviolently, gradually deepened in the practice and guidance they had been given. But eventually, too, he became a leader of a community. Eventually, too, he had responsibility of being a general, a warrior, and a warrior, and a legislator, and a husband, a father. And at the end of his life, he had nothing for himself. He took nothing for himself. When the Prophet Muhammad died, the only thing in his room, all he had was a room, the only thing he had in his room, I think, was a couple of dates, a straw mat, and a block to rest his head on. And he could have had everything. In fact, he was offered everything right at the beginning. People of Mecca came and said, "Listen, you know, you want to be our king? Is that what you want? You can be our king. You want women? I'll get you women. You want wealth? Whatever you want, you can have it. Just leave the status quo as it is." He said, "You know, if you were to offer me the sun and the moon, I couldn't betray the message that's been given to me." At the very end of his life, he appeared before his community. And he said, "You know, I have one question. Have I delivered the message to you? Have I been fastidious in bringing the message to you?" That was the only thing on his mind. So this is at the heart, this is at the core of this tradition. It was a human being who lived in the remembrance of God, who was not seeking power, was not seeking control over others, and is really an extraordinary example of someone who was victorious over his own ego. Let me just read a couple of hadith that I think typify what he was like. These words were carved on the hilt of the sword of the Prophet. "Forgive those who wrong you. Join with him who cuts you off. do good to whomever does evil to you, and speak the truth, even if it be against yourself. He who humbles himself for the sake of God, him will God exalt. He is small in his own mind and yet great in the eyes of the people. And he who is proud and haughty, God will render him contemptible. And he is small in the eyes of the people, though great in his own mind. I could read hundreds like this. Hundreds of remarkably clear, coherent, powerful counsels on how to be a human being. And moreover, they continued with Hazrati Ali, who is the next in line in the chain of Sufism, and through whom all the Sufi orders but one are descended. Ali was a great orator and extraordinary in communicating very practical things about being a human being. There are many definitions of Sufism, but one of them that I think is relevant to our discussion right now is very simple. Sufism is good character. Now, that's what they say in church too. Well, minus the Sufism part. I mean, all moralists preach to us about be good, be good, be good. It's a moral imperative. But it's an external imperative. It's a should. But what we need and what Sufism ought to be is something from the interior that, let's say, it's a journey within the soul of the human being or a maturing process for the human being. And in that process of maturity, the ripened fruit of that maturity is not somebody out there in the cosmos spread, you know, dissolved in the universe, not some abstract persona, not some abstract state of enlightenment or perfection. Have you ever seen such a thing? I haven't. But a human being who you would like to have a cup of tea with, a human being you would trust as a babysitter. You would trust your children with such a person. A human being who has character, has humanness, has strength, has will, and yet not self-will, not ego. Someone who is fully developed in the dimension of humanness. Now, the reason why Sufism is like this is because this is how it began. It began with the exemplar of the Prophet Muhammad and all the generations of Sufis that came after that, who all took the Prophet as a moral model. And in this culture also developed the virtues of what are called adab. Adab is a really important Sufi word. It could be translated as conscious courtesy, mindful relationship. And this is at the heart of Sufi life and Sufi practice. I was once with a group of sheikhs. They were all five or six people who were recognized sheikhs of traditional Sufi orders, but they were all Westerners. They were all Americans. We said, well, what is it? What's the essence of this whole thing we're involved with? And these were all from different, diverse orders. And somebody said, I think it's adab. And we all agreed. There was no more discussion. Everybody said, yeah, that's it. That's the most important thing we've learned. Or, excuse me, we haven't learned it. But we're working on that. that mindful, conscious relationship that honors and respects other human beings, that reshapes the nafs, or the ego, into a servant rather than a tyrant. Now, what it takes to support this process of developing an adab and in taming our egoism, many things support that. Things like meditation and worship and fasting and service. Higher states of consciousness help this. But maybe if you see the point I'm making, our goal is not higher consciousness alone. It's not some state of intoxicated bliss, that we all have a right to ecstasy in our lives, in everything in due proportion. Higher consciousness is beautiful, but higher consciousness not balanced with common sense, human discernment and responsibility and creativity, higher consciousness alone won't do it. It's not enough. You know, I'm giving you my conclusions. You know, it took a while to reach these conclusions, I hope you realize, because I tried some of those other things, lived with, climbed those other ladders. So, there's the example of the Prophet Muhammad and all the great Sufis that have exemplified this life. But there's also, even more fundamental, is the revelation of the Quran, which came to the Prophet Muhammad and was, as I said, this like crystal from which so much unfolded, developed organically. So what is the Quran? For one thing, most of us don't know how to read it. We approach it with all kinds of misconceptions. And I'll also say that Muslims often do the same. Many Muslims don't really know how to read the Quran, or they, at least one could offer a pretty strong critique of how the Quran is grasped and understood. And my own work, by the way, is I was a publisher for years, and in the last 3 years, my day job has been as the co-director for an international project to develop a new approach to education within an Islamic Sufi perspective. But we don't use the word Sufi because we need this to go out, get through all the filters. And it's working with an international team. It's working with the best minds in the Muslim world and in the Sufi world to sort of offer some new ways of grasping the essence of what Islam is. So that's my job, and I've been privileged to be immersed in a lot of materials and to meet with very deep thinkers and spiritual practitioners, and to learn many things about this. So we don't know how to read the Quran. For lots of reasons. For one thing, we have to remember how it was revealed. It was revealed in response to the needs of the Prophet's life and his community over 23 years. There was a dialogue going on between the Prophet and something, whatever that is, whatever the Quran is. There was a dialogue going on. And in response to the needs of this community, guidance was given. But not just in terms of practical circumstances, the essential guidance was shaping a mentality, shaping hearts in a certain way. It was spiritually transformative. When it came into the world, it was not like some, I like to say, it wasn't like some new religion coming in like a bulldozer to kind of just bulldoze all the other religions out of the way. No, it came down from a vertical dimension. It changed people's lives. It made them begin to care for each other, take care of each other. It put the divine at the center of their reality. It melted their hearts. It made them weep when they heard it. Omar, the biggest bully in all of Mecca, was coming to kill Muhammad. He had a sword in hand because he was really pissed off that his sister had become a Muslim, and he was ready to just chop Muhammad's head off if he could get within close enough to do it. And he busted into the room and he heard the Quran being recited. And by the time he got within striking distance of Muhammad, he fell to the ground and wept at what he was hearing. So something came into the world, and it wasn't an orthodoxy. It wasn't even a religion, as we often think of religion. It was something quite universal and profound. And the one thing I hope to convey to you and maybe sort of stimulate in you is the possibility of seeing how pure this message is and how to get it disentangled from our preconceptions about Islam, for one thing, our preconceptions about religion, because those of us who have come from a Judeo-Christian background, we hear certain words and we think we know what they mean and we react against them, even words like faith and truth and worship. People have allergies and attitudes about some of these things. But there's something else going on that I hope to convey to you. And Kedin, would you go back to the table back there and would you see if near my name there's a paper that says the Islamic Declaration of Peace on it? What the Prophet was bringing, first of all, just really basic things to clarify. What does the Quran say about all of us, all of humanity? Does it say you must become Muslim to be saved? No. Does it say that the criteria of spiritual well-being is your good actions and your mindfulness of God? Yes. Does it say that any beliefs will save you or any exclusive beliefs are necessary? No. Does it denigrate other religions? No. Does it establish a pluralistic framework in the 6th century? Yes. I gathered up verses from the Quran and put them on a single page, and there are copies of this at the back of the room. It's called the Islamic Declaration of Peace or Covenant of Peace. I'd like this to appear in newspapers in Houston and Atlanta and Chicago and elsewhere. And I'd like people who are scared to death of Islam and the Quran and so forth to hear this and maybe rethink their position. So I'm going to read you this, and I try to hear it as if, as if you were the Prophet Muhammad, as if somehow you suddenly found yourself overwhelmed and overawed with a divine presence. And that presence has something to say to you. All of us. I think the only thing I need to explain is that the pronoun we, though it sounds like many, is the pronoun for God. You could even say it's the pronoun for God's attributes, but it's not God's. Allah speaks sometimes as a we. O mankind, truly we have created you male and female, and have made you nations and tribes, that you may know one another. Truly the most noble of you in the sight of God is the most God-conscious. And for every community of faith, we have appointed ways of worship which they ought to observe. Hence, do not let those who follow other ways draw you into dispute on this score, but summon them to their sustainer. Truly, those who keep the faith, and the Jews, and the Christians, and the Sabaeans, a catch-all term, you could say, for all other unknown faiths, whoever believes in God and the last day and performs virtuous deeds, surely their reward is with their sustainer. And no fear shall come upon them, nor shall they grieve. It was we who revealed the Torah. Therein was guidance and light. And by its standard, the Jewish people have been judged by the prophets who surrendered to God's will, as well as by the rabbis and the doctors of law. For to them, the protection of God's book was entrusted. And if any fail to judge by what God has revealed, including the Torah, they are no better than unbelievers. We ordained for the children of Israel that if anyone slew a person, unless it be for murder or for spreading corruption in the land, it would be as if he slew all of humanity. And if anyone saved a life, it would be as if he had saved the life of all of humanity. We ordained for them a life for a life, an eye for an eye, an ear for an ear, and equivalents in harm done. But if anyone, by way of charity, forgoes that retaliation, it is an act of atonement for yourself. And in their footsteps, we sent Jesus, the Son of Mary, confirming the law that had come before him. We sent him the gospel, and therein was guidance and light, in confirmation of the law that had come before him, a guidance and a reminder to those who are conscious of God. To Jesus, the Son of Mary, we gave clear signs and strengthened him with the Holy Spirit. O you who keep the faith, when you go abroad in the way of God, be clear and circumspect, and say not to anyone who offers you a greeting of peace, you are not a believer. To each community among you, we have prescribed a law and a broad way of life. If God had so willed, he would have made all of you into a single people, but his plan is to test you in what he has given you. So strive as in a race for all virtues. The goal of you all is to God. It is he that will show you the truth of the matters in which you differ. And do not argue with the followers of earlier revelations except in the most gentle manner. The followers of earlier revelations are not all alike. Among them, there are upright people who recite God's verses through the night and prostrate themselves before him. They believe in God and the last day and enjoin the doing of what is right and forbid the doing of what is wrong, and vie with one another in doing good works, and they are among the righteous. And whatever good they do, they shall never be denied the reward thereof, for God has full knowledge of those who are conscious of him. Goodness and evil cannot be equal. Repel evil with something better. Then the one who hated you will become your friend and intimate. And no one will be granted such goodness except those who exercise patience and self-restraint. None but persons of the greatest good fortune. And when the evil one incites discord, seek refuge in God. He is the one who hears and knows all things. And the servants of the infinitely compassionate one are those who walk on the earth in humility. And when the ignorant accosts them, their only reply is peace. Let there be no compulsion in religion. Truth stands out clearly from error. Whoever rejects evil and has faith in God has grasped the most trustworthy, unfailing handhold. And God hears and knows all things. God is the protector of those who have faith. From the depths of darkness, he will lead them forth into the light. The Quran. So, this impulse, maybe you can feel the impulse behind these words, the power of it, the beauty of it, the clarity of it. One of its effects, one of its interesting effects, is that it established the main categories, concepts, and vocabulary of a spirituality. And it was not a spirituality that claimed to be something new. In fact, its claim was that it was a clarification of the primordial religion of humanity. And it's in that sense that this is a universal teaching, that it is a sweeping away of the man-made distortions that have crept into revelation over time, to represent it in a way that is clear, relatively simple, without any complex theology or irrational beliefs. In fact, the only leap of faith one needs to hear and receive, be receptive to what the Quran has to say, the only thing you have to sort of grant it is that the divine might bother to speak with us. Or that there could be something in the, and I hesitate to say the collective psyche of humanity, because I really believe, I mean, if you take the Quran at its word, it says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, all praise be to the Rabb, the sustainer and educator of all the universes, plural, universes. But what is revelation? What could revelation be? Could it have come, you know, from Muhammad's subconscious? You can try out a psychological explanation for it. But the fact is, Muhammad's speech was different than the speech of the Quran. Muhammad made mistakes. The Quran doesn't even make a scientific mistake. I mean, so much of what's in the Quran holds up today in terms of contemporary science. There's nothing that really exhibits a world, you know, the scientific worldview of that time and that place. It says we created all of life from water. It says we unfolded the cosmos from a singularity. It has lots of these things. It says we wrapped the day around the night. Did you ever have, I know a lot of you, especially who are Llewellyn students, you pay a lot of attention to your dreams. Did you ever have a dream that was not your own, or that you could not clearly identify as something you could have ever created? You know, thoughts different than your own, a voice different than your own, knowledge far different than your own. So who is the dreamer? If that can happen to an individual, if something can come into an individual's own psyche that is inspired from beyond the apparent boundaries of that psyche, might it be that that same dreaming power could have dreamt a dream for humanity? Might that dream have, you know, been given to prophets at different times? As a message and a guidance from the source of humanness itself, from the creator of humanness itself. This, I mean, what begins, what happens to Sufis who sort of gradually, and like me, very slowly, even with some resistance, grew into this perspective on reality. I only very gradually, over years, decades, slowly came to trust it, because I was let go of religion as such a long time ago, and as I will keep reminding us, this is not religion anyway. But what if that creative power which developed the human being, created humanness in all of its immense dimensions, because the human being is not a small thing. The human being is immense. What if that creative power, in some way, in some terms that could be apprehendable to human beings themselves, wanted to give